people out of desperation would do anything you tell them to do. And they spend thousands of US dollars on add-ons that are really not going to change much in the outcome.
Yet you're so right. And it's so important for us as physicians to tell patients, these supplements work. Okay, only this list, but not, you know, 500 of them. Take the ones that I suggest. Believe it or not, some of these supplements can have a negative effect on your cycle as well. So paying attention for patients to pay attention to the ones that their doctors recommend is very important.
This podcast is meant to provide information on reproductive health. It does not establish a physician-patient relationship, and we would urge you to contact your treating provider regarding your care.
Have you ever wondered about fertility treatments in other parts of the world? You've been listening to my podcast, and we talk a lot about what happens here in the United States. But what is the experience of patients in other parts of the world? Are their treatments different than ours? You don't want to miss today's podcast. Today, I'm delighted to have Dr. Diana Kayal. She is a practicing reproductive endocrinologist and fertility specialist in Dubai, and she brings three decades of experience. So Dr. Kayal, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm delighted to be there.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. I want our listeners first, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you practice medicine in different countries, because most of my listeners are here in the United States. So it's so fascinating to have someone practicing in a different part of the world. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice in throughout the last three decades and in different countries.
So I'm Diana Kayal. I am born in Lebanon, so I'm Lebanese. I grew up in Tunisia, and I did my MD in Tunisia, and then I went to Brussels to do my OB-GYN, reproductive endocrinology, and IVF. And then I hit the Middle East in 1997, and I've worked throughout the GCC countries, from Bahrain to Qatar to Saudi, and I settled in Dubai in 2012. So I've been in Dubai for a long time now. I'm a founding member of several IVF clinics around the region, Bornholm Fertility Clinic, Dubai Branch, IVF International Clinic, and now I'm at another clinic where I am a specialist reproductive endocrinologist and IVF specialist. I've previously had several positions like medical director, senior lecturer. So all that has put me in a position where I can see people from different kinds of origins and nationalities. And the fact that I speak several languages, I speak Arabic, English, French fluently, and fairly good Italian, which allows me to understand people from different parts of the world.
That's fascinating. So you must have patients that travel from all parts of the world to come and see you.
Absolutely. I have French-speaking people from Africa, and I have Northern African people that come because I speak the dialect. I see Arab population as well as Western community here in the UAE.
Well, tell us a little bit about how is reproductive endocrinology and infertility practiced differently in Europe versus the Middle East? And then how does it vary from population to population as you see different populations?
The practice in general for IVF is basically the same. Probably it is a little bit more regulated in Europe and the US than it is here, particularly when it comes to donations and surrogacy. This is not really allowed at all, any kind or any form of donation like egg donation, sperm donation, embryo donation, which limits us in the practice of reproductive endocrinology and IVF because we have to use the patient's own eggs. And arriving to a certain limit of age, it becomes really very complicated to deal with patients. In general, the treatments are fairly the same. Medicine is extremely advanced here in Dubai, and we have access to all kinds of technologies.
And so third-party donation, like donor egg, donor sperm, surrogacy, third-party reproduction, some aspects of that, or many aspects of that, sounds like it's limited.
It is not allowed. Donation is simply not allowed in the GCC countries.
And many of that for political and religious reasons, correct?
Probably religious reasons more than political.
Wonderful. So you must then have patients that you have to take further along in their IVF journey because egg donation is not an option.
Absolutely. It's not an option. Some people from the Western community, non-Arabs or non-Muslims, that would say opt to go abroad. So I have to refer them somewhere else to have their treatment, like in the US for surrogacy or Europe, to have donation, be part of donation programs.
Oh, that's fantastic. And so I see a lot of patients, by the way, that come from abroad to the United States for particularly surrogacy. I did surrogacy to have my only child. And so I get a lot of patients that come from all parts of the world for a surrogacy. We also get some for egg donation as well. So yeah, it's so interesting how based on religious and political reasoning, people travel to other parts of the world for their medical treatment.
Absolutely. And we receive a fair amount of people coming for gender selection, which is not allowed in certain countries. So they travel to Dubai to have PGTA genetic testing, let's say, and choose the gender of their child to be born.
That's interesting that you say that, because I've had some patients from Europe come here to the United States as well, because DFW is a international airport. You can fly to Dallas-Fort Worth from pretty much anywhere in the world nonstop. I've had a lot of patients come from Europe for gender selection with the pre-implantation genetic testing, aneuploidy screening. Just for our listeners, I'll remind you, pre-implantation genetic testing, aneuploidy screening, that's where we take several cells off the embryo, typically the trophoectoderm, and we analyze for things like Down syndrome, Turner syndrome, trisomy 16, trisomy 18, monosomy X, so a full karyotype or aneuploidy screening. But as part of that, we get gender information on the embryo. And so as you mentioned, Dr. Kayal, many patients may want gender selection. And a lot of what I see is they have children of one gender and they like to have a child of the opposite gender is a lot of what I see. So I get mostly 50-50 in terms of like male versus female gender selection. Is that the case there as well?
We get more demands for a male fetus, actually, male embryos to be transferred back. And again, it is for, I presume, family balancing for certain regions, certain countries. But in the Islam and Muslim community, a boy in the family is extremely important. So if they have a family of girls only, or even one boy, they would rather have another boy than the family being only girls.
This is so interesting, and I'm so glad that's why we're having this discussion, because it varies from country to country and views and how medicine is practiced. So I'm so delighted that you're here. And then one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about today in terms of the population, it is my understanding that marriage between blood relatives are more common in the Middle East and certain parts of Asia. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes. That is very, very common. Although it is becoming less than when it used to be. I used to see more cousins being married to each other, but it is getting, awareness is coming along, education awareness. So we see less of it, but it's still very common. Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about that education and awareness, because for our listeners, so consanguinity is when there's marriage between blood relatives. Many times that can lead to infertility, miscarriages. So tell us a little bit about what you see in these couples.
Some of the governments, and particularly here in the UAE, the government is trying to raise awareness through campaigns. And if there is, you know, a same blood marriage, you know, cousins get married to each other, they suggest to them to have a genetic screening prior to having a conception. So we do either a whole genome sequencing or whole exome sequencing, because as you know, if both parents are carrier of the same gene, there is a certain risk of having a child affected with the disease. So we do have cases of pre-implantation genetic testing for monogenic diseases. I'm currently treating a couple that have three genetic conditions at the same time for which the genetic lab has to test, you know. So that is one thing. Or the other part of the people, they don't, you know, if the community is not really aware and they marry each other and then they get a child affected. And that is when the genetic counseling comes in and we step in to do the genetic testing for the genes. And obviously at the same time, we do the testing for the chromosomes because you don't want a child that is not affected by a genetic disease, but has a Down syndrome. So it doesn't make sense. So you test both obviously at the same time.
Amazing. For our listeners, I'm going to clarify. So consanguinity, marriage between blood relatives. For all of us on this planet, many of us carry genes for silent or recessive disorder. So a silent or recessive disorder means you just carried the gene but don't have the disease and will never get the disease, but that gene just passes on within generations. Now it becomes a problem, though, when a child gets one copy of the gene from the egg and one copy of the gene from the sperm. With two copies of the gene from a recessive disorder, then there is elevated risk of having the full-blown disease. So that's for the autosomal recessive disorders. X-linked recessive disorders, where the female is a carrier, but male offsprings have the full-blown disease, that can also be an issue. So the genetic testing or genetic carrier screening or whole genome sequencing that Dr. Kael is referring to means that they're looking for all of these recessive disorders that this couple, and in this example that she's giving, that this couple has three of them in common because there's a marriage between blood relatives. And because they have three of them in common, if the child gets these diseases or inherits two copies of the same gene, can actually now have the full-blown disease of all three of these diseases. So this is where pre-implantation genetic testing, monogene, so testing for a specific gene. And in this example that you just gave to us, you're probably testing for three different genes in this couple. And you're absolutely right. If you're doing the PGTM, so testing for a specific gene, why not just go ahead and do the aneuploidy screening as well? Since you're there, it's the same biopsy. Why not run it as well for the aneuploidy screening? But you're right. And I'm so glad that the government is making awareness now of the increased risk of passing on recessive disorders when there's marriage between blood relatives. Well, this is great. So tell us a little bit about fertility in other parts of the world and where do you see fertility going? Tell us what is real and what really is being oversold. I will tell you, because I'm on social media all the time, the algorithm for social media, they send me everything that's infertility and I get so much information on things like get pregnant naturally over 40 if you take this and we'll sell you this and you'll be pregnant at 45 naturally. And as a fertility doctor, I'm raising eyebrows. Yes, some people do get pregnant naturally over 40, but those people are the exceptions and not the rule. The majority 40 and older will need true medical treatment. But it bothers me that there's a lot being oversold to people and a lot being sold to people. They're taking advantage of patients' desperation to have a child, and this is being sold to patients. So tell us what's real and what's being oversold, and what do you see in other parts of the world?
The reality is that we have progressed a lot since I've been started practicing in 1997 until now. The The egg collection procedures have progressed. We do transvaginal egg collections. The lab has progressed. The culture medias, the culture of the embryos and the selection of the embryos. So this is the reality. And mostly it's the improvement of the lab and the techniques in the lab and the transfer of a single embryo, tested or not tested, but that's another story. What is really oversold, as you say, is all these supplements. I see patients coming with a shopping bag full of supplements. I mean, you name it. And it's true, some of them might help and some of them are not helpful. And you don't know at some stage what to say to patients because there is a habit, probably, I don't know if you have it in the US, but people go around shopping for doctors. So they see Dr. A and Dr. B and then Dr. C. And each doctor would prescribe some kind of supplement. And the patient ends up with a shopping bag of supplements and doesn't know what to do. So you need somebody to put a stop or take this. This is realistic and this is not realistic. So this is pre-IVF or during your cycle of IVF. But then you hit all the add-on treatments, whether the aspirin, the prednisolone, the antralipids, the PRP in the ovaries for low ovarian reserve. And there is, I mean, the HFEA, the Human Fertilization and Embryology Act in the UK, has put a list, you know, the red light traffic sign to say this is effective, this is not effective. But people out of desperation would do anything you tell them to do. And they spend thousands of US dollars on add-ons that are really not going to change much in the outcome.
Yeah, you're so right. And it's so important for us as physicians to tell patients, these supplements work. Okay, only this list, but not, you know, 500 of them. Take the ones that I suggest. Believe it or not, some of these supplements can have a negative effect on your cycle as well. So paying attention for patients to pay attention to the ones that their doctors recommend is very important. Many of the newer treatments, like PRP, those types of things, we're still studying them. We still don't know if they're great. For our listeners, PRP, platelet-rich plasma, and that's where we take your blood cells. So we draw blood from you. We spin it down. Some places may even add growth factors to it, but most places will just use your blood that's spun down and they inject it directly into your uterus to help with uterine lining, directly into your ovaries to help perhaps improve egg reserve. We know a lot of orthopedic surgeons use it, injecting it directly into joints to help heal joints for a patient to avoid having orthopedic surgery. These things we do believe work, but we don't have enough data as yet. We do PRP here in the United States. It's not done commonly. It's only for patients who have severe diminished ovarian reserve. They're not ready to move on to donor egg, or patients with a very thin lining, and we're doing everything possible. And the uterus, the lining isn't thickening up, and chances of pregnancy is less when that happens for a frozen embryo transfer. And this woman is not ready or cannot afford surrogacy. PRP can potentially improve the uterine lining. So PRP, platelet-rich plasma, in the use of fertility today, it's still something that we're using as quote-unquote a last resort, as something we're going to throw it at you when nothing else has worked, but we're using it for very difficult cases. We do not have substantial data on this at this present point in time, but I get it. As someone myself who struggled with infertility, you want to do everything that's possible to know that you've unturned every stone, you tried everything before you moved on to the next step, whether it be donor egg and or surrogacy. And some people want to do them. And for me, I'm fine if patients want to do it because, okay, you want to do it, let's try it. But we still don't know full data on a lot of these things. But people want to try it. They want a chance. They're hopeful. And I get that. I get where they're coming from with that. But it's up to us to tell patients what's real, what's not real, what's being oversold. And also, you're absolutely right. The technology in the lab has improved significantly in the last several decades. I mean, just vitrification alone, the fact that we can freeze embryos and not have to do a fresh transfer. I remember back in the day, we had to do fresh transfers because the freezing technique was not very good. And some patients had ovarian hyperstimulation that would prolong into the first trimester. Their estrogen levels were very high. We didn't give them enough time for their estrogen levels to come back down and reset. And then even though the ovaries produced a lot of eggs from the ovarian stimulation and the high estrogen levels, those high estrogen levels actually had a negative effect on the uterus and a negative effect on implantation. And so now with vitrification and all the improvements in the lab, I mean, even in the 90s, ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, really picked up. Prior to that, a man having a biological child was not possible prior to intracytoplasmic sperm injection. So for our listeners, an intracytoplasmic sperm injection is where the embryologist picks up a single sperm and injects it directly into a single egg, and therefore improving fertilization, particularly for men with abnormal semen parameters. So the technology has improved significantly.
Totally. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And the modern IVF is stimulate, get as many eggs as you want in one go, freeze and do your embryo transfers nice and easy when the patient is ready.
Yeah, and it really allows patient that chance to kind of freeze all their embryos and then get pregnant with a singleton at a time. Because, you know, back when we started, we transferred more than one embryo because the technology was not very good. And we had multiples. We had women pregnant with more than one fetus at a time. And that led to preterm labor, bed rest for many months. If they delivered too early, the babies were in the neonatal ICU for an extended amount of time. Sometimes they lost the entire pregnancy if they delivered too early and the fetus was not at the stage where it could survive in the NICU. And so the technology has improved significantly where now we can transfer one embryo at a time in the United States. And with the pre-implantation genetic testing, aneuploidy screening, it really helps us in selecting that embryo for the transfer.
Totally agree with you on it. People think that transferring to embryos will increase their chances of getting pregnant. This is absolutely not true. And the reality is that it will increase the risk of complications for the mother and for the babies to come. And even if the babies come out of the NICU and, you know, go through childhood easy, you can still see the effect of prematurity when they go to school later in life, delayed learning or delayed speech or delayed. So the problem is really big. It costs a lot of money, not only to the community, but also to the parents. If you think of it, having two kids at the same time, breastfeeding, nappies, bottles, school, university fees. I mean, who can afford to send two kids at the same time to universities? I can't. I don't know if you can. But having twins has a huge socioeconomical impact, not only on the community, but on the parents themselves.
Yeah, certainly with having more than one crying baby at night, you're never going to sleep. It's when one goes to bed, the next one wakes up. And yeah, it's pretty rough. Thank you for listening today. Stay tuned for the second half of this conversation with Dr. Kael. You don't want to miss this. We're going to talk deeper about fertility in different parts of the world, as well as advances in the IVF lab, including artificial intelligence.
Pioneer.